Hello, good morning and welcome. It is a delight to be back with you as we do a 6-month, 22-lesson course in church history. Last week, I mentioned that when I became a new member at Village 7, I was told that 5 things were true of Village 7 Presbyterian. That we're Protestant, Reformed, Calvinist, Presbyterian, and Evangelical. We're all of those things. And I thought, great, I wonder what the pastor's going to tell us about that. And he didn't, he launched into a sermon. But because I had studied the history of Christianity at university, I put together this course. And it is a bus tour of 250 years of church history, starting with the Protestant Reformation and will end up at the American Revolution. How exciting! Because next year is the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, which was written during the Revolutionary War. So, not unlike Luke did in the book of Acts, he traced the spread of the gospel north and west. Now, the gospel went many other places, but his purpose was to go north and then west to Rome. We are going to go to America, but we are going to start in Germany with Martin Luther, and we'll talk about what it means to be Protestant. Then, at the simultaneously or contemporaneously, we will go to Switzerland, to Zurich, where we'll meet Ulrich Zwingli. He and Luther were the same age, and that was the beginning of the Reformed movement. A generation later, in Geneva, Switzerland, John Calvin also developed a Reformed theology. And when you put together Zwingli and Calvin, you get Calvinism or the Reformed tradition. Then we're going to go north to Holland, where we will look at the Synod of Dort in Dordrecht, where the 5 points of Calvinism came from. Then we will go to Edinburgh, Scotland, where John Knox preached what he had learned from John Calvin in Geneva, and Presbyterianism became the religion of Scotland. At about the same time, refugees, and John Knox was a refugee, he had fled from England during the reign of Bloody Mary, Mary I, Mary Tudor. A number of other Christians had fled from England and gone to the continent. They went to Geneva, they went to Strasbourg, they went to Frankfurt. They returned to England and were known as the Puritans. They wanted a more pure form of worship than what they saw in the Church of England. But wait, that's not all. How much would you pay? Don't answer. Because in 1620, we are going to leave Plymouth, England, and sail to Plymouth Rock in the New World. We're going to look at the Pilgrims and the Puritans. We just celebrated the Pilgrims for Thanksgiving Day. We're going to look at the Puritans who came 9 or 10 years later, by the thousands, by the tens of thousands. Both the Pilgrims and the Puritans were Calvinistic. So Calvinism comes to the New World. Then in the 1700s, we're going to look at the Great Awakening, Evangelicalism, the Enlightenment in the early 1700s, Rationalism, and then finally, we'll end with the founding fathers of the American Revolution, a combination of both evangelicalism and rationalism. You're probably wondering, how could I learn more than what I'm going to get this morning? If you go to BillPetra.com/Martin-Luther, who we're going to talk about today and next week, I wrote 6 articles back in 2017 on the 500th anniversary of the nailing of the 95 Theses to the Wittenberg Door. Everybody was crazy about Luther a few years ago. So go there, 6 articles, 6 or 7 articles on Luther. If you'd like to learn more about the history of Christmas, I understand Christmas is in the air. Go to BillPetra.com/Christmas. I just wrote a new article on the history of White Christmas. It is the most popular Christmas song ever in history. It was the number one song in 1942, 43, 44, 45, and 46. And if you'd like to find the slides that I'm presenting and the recordings, go to BillPetra.com/compass. So for example, if you missed last week, you can get the recording. This is what the website looks like. Go to the right side for the PDF. The recording has a little microphone in front of it. And if I have any articles I've written that are relevant to the lesson, I put those in there. Yes, question?
Do any of the articles on Christmas substantiate the time of Christ's birth as 8 p.m.?
No. I made that up on the spot.
Will you go back to how you get to last week's lesson?
Oh, yes. So go to BillPetra.com/compass.
Okay.
These are all of the lessons going forward. The way to find the slides, far right, last week was our introduction. It was December 7th. There's a recording. And then other articles. Are we ready? Let's jump into church history, which is divided into 4 unequal parts. The first is called ancient history. Then there's medieval, from about the time of the fall of Rome until the rise of the Renaissance. The modern period, there's an early modern and a late modern. The early modern is the flourishing of the Renaissance, and the later modern is the flourishing of the Enlightenment. And then postmodern, which we're not going to talk about hardly at all, starting in the 1900s in Europe and starting in America in February of 1964. The ancient period is theological definition. The church fathers, there were 2 groups of church fathers. One were called apologists, and they explained Christianity to a pagan Roman world. The others were called the theologians, and they wrestled with issues of orthodoxy and heresy. And there were lots of them during the early part of the church. The medieval period we would call a time of theological darkness, which I'll explain in a couple of slides. And then the modern period was theological reformation. The Renaissance, starting in late 1300s, really the 1400s, especially in Italy, in terms of art and architecture, 1500s in England in terms of literature. William Shakespeare would be an example of Renaissance literature. The Renaissance gave us 2 things. The Reformation grew up in light of the Renaissance, and the Renaissance ended with the Enlightenment in the 1700s. A third way of looking at this is the ancient period was a time of formulation of some of our theology, clearing up of heresies. Origen and Augustine are some of the big names. The medieval period, as we talked about last week, was a time when the Roman Church said, the way you get to heaven is by observing the sacraments, the 7 sacraments, and by that you can merit the merit of Christ, which is held in a treasury of merit distributed by the Roman Church. Peter Lombard and Thomas Aquinas were some of the big names during this period, the scholastic period of church history. Today we're going to look at three of the proto-reformers. These were reformers before Martin Luther. How exciting. Modern period is Martin Luther and Calvin. We'll talk about Luther today and next week. And Kant and Schleiermacher, we're not going to talk about at all. Okay, so summary, the death of Christ. Christ was perfect, and according to medieval Roman church theology, his merit, the merit of Christ's suffering and his perfect life, went into a treasury of merit in the sky that was distributed by the Roman church to individuals. How do you know that you're going to go to heaven when you die? That's the question. So in this theology, Christ's death was effective for no one, but was available to everyone through the church, through the Roman church. We'll talk more about that. So Thomas Aquinas said, we initially got an infusion of grace when Christ died, but as we do meritorious works, we might move progressively towards salvation. Very different view of salvation than we have in the Protestant world. So the idea is, as we do our meritorious works, which would be works of mercy, going on a pilgrimage, giving to the poor, etc., we have more infusion of righteousness in our lives. The reformers took an entirely different view. It's not the infusion of righteousness, it's the imputation of righteousness from Christ. His righteousness is imputed to us by God's grace that we receive through faith instantaneously. Justification is instantaneous. That's revolutionary. That was the Reformation. Okay, that's by way of review. Where are we going today? Here are your learning objectives. By the end of the session, you should be able to identify key proto-reformers, list the key events and people in Luther's early life, and describe some of the early aspects of his teaching. Here's the first one, John Wycliffe. He's called the Morning Star of the Reformation. British. He was a professor at Oxford University, and he taught the primacy of the Scripture and Christ over against that of the Pope. In fact, he said, if the Pope should try to amass too much temporal power, too much earthly power, he might be considered the Antichrist. He translated, he's the first one to translate the Bible into English, but too early. The movable type printing press was 58 years later, Gutenberg's printing press. So copies of his Bible were hand copied. He attacked transubstantiation, which we'll talk about later. That's the idea within the Roman Church that the bread and the wine become the real physical presence of Jesus mystically every Sunday morning at Mass. He said, no, this is nonsense. He inspired Martin Luther. He also condemned the dogma of purgatory, which is that when you die, if you don't have enough merit in your life, you go to this place where you are purged of those sins. Purgatory. He said, nonsense, that's not in the Bible. The use of relics. Relics are the bones or other accessories of the saints that by revering them, venerating them, you could gain more merit. People would go on pilgrimages to see relics. Nonsense. Pilgrimages, going on pilgrimages, To get time out of purgatory? No. The practice of confession or penance? No. Indulgences? Right out. He said all of these are wrong. Now, he was condemned by the Roman Church. However, he was not killed because he had powerful friends amongst the nobility. One of those friends was the Queen of England. Her name was Anne of Bohemia. Bohemia is the ancient name for what we now call the Czech Republic. And she grew up in Prague. She got married to the King of England. She was 16, he was 15. And they were married for 12 years, fell in love with each other, though they got together through diplomacy. Anyway, so this increased the trade between England and Bohemia. Anyway, she loved John Wycliffe. She read his Gospels, and she invited her friends from Prague to come to Oxford and study under John Wycliffe. Okay, let's move on. Speaking of Prague, there's a man named John Hus. In the Bohemian language, it's Jan Hus. He was a professor and the dean of philosophy at the University of Prague. It's called the Charles University in Prague, beautiful city. He translated Wycliffe from English into the Bohemian language of the Czech Republic. He said, Jesus is the only pontiff, not the Pope. He said a lot of the same things that Wycliffe said, but he said them in a way that got the attention of the church, and especially Anne of Bohemia's brother, who was the emperor. His name was Sigismund. He, at the prodding of the Roman church, called Jan Hus to appear at the Council of Constance to defend his teachings or to recant and return to the arms of Mother Church. He said that he was promised safe conduct by the emperor, but when he got there, he was imprisoned because the emperor was more interested in peace than he was in truth. And so Jan Hus refused to recant what he had taught. He said it would not be wise. He said, I will be happy to recant everything if you can show me from the scriptures. Sound familiar? Stay tuned. So they burned him at the stake. They piled wood up to his neck, and the fire wouldn't catch, and some woman put some brush on the fire. How ironic. And the night before he was burned at the stake, he wrote this down. He said, today you are burning a goose, because his name, Hus, means goose in the Bohemian language. But 100 years from now, the swan will sing. Him you will not burn, him you will listen to. Ooh, foreshadowing. All right, this is the town square in Prague. I was there 19 years ago. This is a statue of Jan Hus. Tall, he wasn't tall, he was short and fat. But you don't make statues that look like that. Anyway, so I talked to the people in Prague and I said, what do you think of Jan Hus? Because Prague used to be called the City of 100 Spires. It was filled with churches. Now it is the most atheist city in Europe. So I asked this woman who was leading this tour, I said, what do you think of Jan Hus? Oh, we love Jan Hus. And I said, why is that? Because he was revolutionary. We love that. Desiderius Erasmus Rotterdamus, the greatest of all the Renaissance humanists, was a guy that we call Erasmus. He went to study at the Sorbonne, the University of Paris. He lived for 3 years in Italy, Belgium, Switzerland, and he was a professor of divinity at Cambridge. Incredibly bright. He was in regular correspondence with 500 of the leading thinkers and politicians all over Europe. People wrote to him and asked his advice, and they followed it. He was brilliant. He wrote In Praise of Folly, which was a satire against the priests and bishops, and he called them the blind leading the blind. Ooh. He said, indulgences, that's a superstition. Ooh. He wrote Freedom of the Will. And he knew Martin Luther, and they exchanged correspondence, and Luther really liked the direction he was going, until he challenged him to join the Reformation. And he said, no, I kind of enjoy being in my ivory tower, and from this position, I'm free to criticize the church, but if I join the Reformation, that'll be a mess. And Luther later condemned him, but Erasmus was told, you know, you laid the egg that hatched into Martin Luther. And Erasmus said, I guess that's true, but I was expecting a different kind of bird. In 1516, he collected all the available Greek manuscripts of the New Testament and put them together in a volume that, thanks now to the movable type printing press, were readily available. We call that today, we call that the Textus Receptus. And it was the collection of Greek manuscripts that were used in many translations of the Bible. Luther used the Textus Receptus. The King James Version uses the Textus Receptus. Okay, question. This is the interactive part of the lesson. In what language was the New Testament originally written? Greek. Anybody know why? It was the mercantile language. It was the trade language. Do you know why?
Alexander the Great.
300 years before Christ, his tutor, Aristotle, said to him, as you go out and conquer, bring the Greek culture to the East and mix and blend the two cultures. So Alexander the Great conquered from Macedonia, Greece, the Middle East, as far as the Indus Valley in India. And he brought the Greek language with him. We call it Koine Greek, which means common Greek. But it is why the New Testament is written in Greek. It's the trade language. The equivalent today would be English. All pilots everywhere in the world speak English. So yes, the answer is Greek. Question number two. In what language was the medieval Bible written?
Latin.
Latin, of course. Think Rome. So after the Greek Empire, we have the Roman Empire for hundreds of years. And Latin progressively became the language when Constantine called the Council of Nicaea, all the bishops spoke Greek. He spoke Latin. He needed a translator to translate Greek to him. Okay, here's the problem with the Latin Bible. It's called the Vulgate. Doesn't mean it's vulgar, it means it's the common Bible. Matthew 4:17 and the topic of penance. In Latin, do penance. Penance is an outward behavior. In Greek, the word is metanoia, repent. It is a change of mind. Literally, it means what your mind is like after. Luke 1:28. In Latin, Ave Maria, grata plena. That's the beginning of the Ave Maria prayer. Hail Mary, full of grace. is the translation into English of the Latin. But that's not what the Greek says. The original Greek is charistou, favored one. It's the same as the word charis, grace. Ephesians 5, 31 through 32, and marriage. In the Latin Bible, marriage is called a sacramentum. So it is one of the seven sacraments. Not in the original Greek, though. It's mysterion. And for those of you who are married, you will confess that marriage is a mystery. So we are making a shift from the language that, the Latin language, which the Bible is not as clearly understood as the original Greek, but not for long. Enter Martin Luther, born in Eisleben. On November 10th, 1483, his parents were probably in service. They were in transit. If you go to the house where he was born, there's a sign over the door that says, "In this house, Dr. Martin Luther was born the 10th of November, 1483. God's word is Luther's lore, which abides forevermore." He was born about 11 p.m., and he was baptized the next day at the Church of St. Peter and St. Paul. So lots of Catholic churches are named St. Peter, St. Paul, or both, or St. Mary's. So you've got Peter, Paul, Mary. Pretty sweet. So he is baptized in this church. It's about a 2-minute walk from the house he was born. He was baptized the next day on St. Martin's Day. If you'd like to learn about who St. Martin of Tours is, where would you go? BillPetra.com. This baptismal font, the top of it is original. This goes back to the life of Martin Luther. If you look in the back of the church, you see what's called a triptych. A triptych is three panels that tell a story. In the center is a picture of the Nativity, and the people who are visiting Mary and Joseph are not shepherds, they're miners. Joseph is holding a lamp that miners take into the mines. Luther's father became a copper miner. And here's another picture. This is Mary, the baby Jesus, and Mary's mother, Saint Anne. Not in the Bible. It shows up about 150 years later in the Gospel of James. There isn't a Gospel of James. This is called pseudepigraphal literature, where you will place a false name on your writing so people would read it. I had to study all this stuff in university. Saint Anne is the patron saint of miners. Okay. He goes to Mansfield, where his father had found work in the copper mines. He progressed until he was an owner and part owner of several copper smelting operations. He becomes a member of the city council, and he rises to the middle class. Dad rises to the middle class. Martin goes to Latin school here, and he lived here for almost a decade. These are his folks, Hans and Margarita Luda. Later in life, Luther changes the pronunciation of his name. I did the same thing when I went to university. My family was known as Petro, but that wasn't our original name. Our original name was Petro Mignans. So when I went to university, I told people my name was Petro. Martin Luda did the same thing later in life. So Hans is from a line of peasants, but Hannah was of a middle-class professional family that had fallen on hard times financially. As they rose to middle class, Dad said, "A free peasant is nobody's slave." And he had great aspirations for his son, Martin. It was said of them that they were small, short, and swarthy, and they were harsh. His mother had left a walnut on the kitchen table, and he absconded with it, and Dad beat him until the blood came. This was not unusual back then, but he became bitter toward his father. His father came to him and reconciled. He loved his parents. He asked their permission when he was considering getting married. He dedicated some of his writing to his parents. Then he goes to a boarding school in Magdeburg, where at about the age of 13, he was exposed to The Imitation of Christ, written by Thomas à Kempis, a devotional book, and he becomes associated with the Brethren of the Common Life. In Eisenach, remember that name, Eisenach, when he was a boy, when he was a teenager, he would sing for his supper. He had a beautiful voice. A group of boys would walk down the street and say, "Sing bread in God's name." He was very musical. He loved the lute. The lute is a stringed instrument. And he was a remarkably good student. He goes, in Eisenach, he goes on to study at the parish church of St. George. This is St. George and the Dragon. Not as popular in the United States, lots of places in Europe. He's the patron saint of various cities. The main kyrka, the main church in Stockholm, Sweden, has a statue of St. George and the Dragon. If you'd like to learn more about St. George and the Dragon, where would you go? St. George is the patron saint of Eisenach. Keep that in mind. He goes to university at Erfurt. Erfurt is the fifth largest city in the Holy Roman Empire, but they didn't have a spare battery for my camera. I was very disappointed. He's 17 or 18 years old. He gets his bachelor's degree in 1 year. He goes on for a master's degree. And Dad says, "You know, son, I've always wanted you to become a lawyer," because parents do that. My dad said, "Bill, I think you'd make a great doctor." I said, "Dad, I can't stand the sight of blood." So Dad says, "I would like you to go to law school." And he buys him the Corpus Juris books, which are law books. It's a library of books, very expensive. But Dad buys it for him, and he's so excited that his son is going to start law school in Erfurt, the big town. On a trip back from visiting his parents, he's several miles outside of Erfurt, and a thunderstorm happens. Lightning strikes, and the air is resonant, and he's knocked down. And he's fearful that he is going to die. And he calls out, "Saint Anne, help me, and I will become a monk." Saint Anne, patron saint of what his father does. So he comes home. He talks to his parents and say, I'm going to become a monk. And Dad goes, "No." 2 weeks later, he goes to the Augustinian monastery in Erfurt. He has one last party with his friends, and he does what he says he's going to do. He promised St. Anne. So he comes to the gate of the cloister, and he leaves behind all his earthly goods, including his lute, which he loved. While he's in the monastery, he was there for 6 years amongst the Augustinian hermits. In 1502, at the age of 1506, at the age of 22, he takes his vows. And the day would start at 3 o'clock in the morning with the first hours of prayer. And then there's fasting, there's work. It was a tough life. And you can see from this picture, as a monk, he was rather thin. This will change in years to come. And he said, "For the first time in my life, I have touched a Bible." In all of his studies, he had never held a Bible in his own hands. He would go to confession every day for hours. And his confessor was so confounded by Luther's profound sense of his own sin, He said, you know what I think you need to do, Martin? You need to go to a new university and study theology. But after he took his vows, he said his first mass at St. Severus in Erfurt. This is what it looks like. His parents came. He was so nervous because he was handling the elements, the bread and the wine. He became paralyzed, and he said, we offer unto thee the living, the true, the eternal God. And he said, I was utterly stupefied and terror-stricken. I thought to myself, with what tongue can I address such majesty, seeing that all men ought to tremble in the presence of even an earthly prince? Who am I? As he rises in the Augustinian monastery, he has to go on a business trip to Rome, which he walks to. There were no Ubers back then, so he walks from Wittenberg down to Rome with another monk. And he gets to the city of Rome, and he stays at the convent of Santa Maria del Popolo, St. Mary of the People. It's on the northern edge of old Rome. And he was in charge of 11 Augustinian monasteries and convents at the time, and he has to come to Rome on business. It's very convenient because it's about a 40-minute walk to St. Peter's at the Vatican, but it's also close to something else, the Scala Sancta, the sacred steps. The story goes like this. Constantine's mother, St. Helena, or St. Helena, was a believer, and she went to the Holy Land, and she brought back all kinds of relics, pieces of the true cross, all kinds of stuff. But she brought back the very steps upon which Jesus stood that led up to Pilate's Praetorium, where Pilate judged Jesus. She brings them back to Rome. She sets them up across the street from St. John's Lateran Church, which is where the popes used to live before the 1500s when they moved to the Vatican. In any event, the thinking is like this. If you climb the steps on your knees, and on every step you say a prayer, either an Our Father or an Ave Maria, when you get to the top of the stairs, one of your dead relatives gets released from purgatory. This is called a plenary indulgence. You get completely out of purgatory, go straight to heaven. So he prayed for his maternal grandmother. And as he's coming up these stairs, and pilgrims still do it today, these words from St. Paul rang in his ears. The just by faith shall live. He said, how can it be that I just climb up these steps and my grandmother gets out of purgatory? This doesn't make sense. He would go to Mass and listen to the Italian priest say the Mass. All the Masses are in Latin, but he has a German accent. They have an Italian accent. But they would speak five times faster than him because you would say Masses for people for their mother who just died, so that they would spend less time in purgatory. And the more Masses you say, the faster you say the Mass, the more money comes in. And then when they were done, they would go down to the brothels. Luther came to hate Rome. And he said, if there is a hell, and he did believe there was a hell, surely Rome is built upon it. So Luther is starting to think. He earns a doctorate at the age of 29, very rare, an earned doctorate, not an honorary doctorate. He has a PhD, and he is teaching the Bible, Psalms, Romans, Galatians, and Hebrews. And while he's teaching, he has an experience in the Augustinian monastery in Wittenberg. This is what it looks like. It's called the Tower Experience. And while he was there, he came to a new realization about God and sin. We would call it a born-again experience. In it the righteousness of God is revealed. That had stood in my way, for I hated the word righteousness of God, which, according to the use and custom of all the teachers, I had been taught to understand philosophically regarding the formal or active righteousness, as they call it, with which God is righteous and punishes the unrighteous sinner, me. In it, the righteousness of God is revealed, as it is written, he who through faith is righteous shall live. This is an alternate way of translating the Greek. There I began to understand that the righteousness of God is that by which the righteous lives by a gift of God, charis, grace, namely by faith. His life begins to change. Meanwhile, John Tetzel is a Dominican doctor who is the Grand Commissioner of Indulgences in Germany. And he's in the next county over. And Luther is noticing that his congregation is not coming to Mass or confession. And he asks them, why? And they said, well, I don't need to. I've got this piece of paper. It's an indulgence. Where did you get that? Oh, I got it from John Tetzel, the next county over. I paid for this piece of paper, and now I don't need to come to Mass, and I don't need to say confession. I don't need to do penance. And he goes, what? Now, Tetzel was a great salesman. When the coin in the coffer, how does it go? As soon as the gold in the casket rings, the rescued soul to heaven springs. It even rhymes in German. He said, if you buy one of these indulgences, you will be cleaner than when you came out of baptism. You will be cleaner than Adam was before the fall. The cross of the seller of indulgence has as much power as the cross of Christ. Well, Martin Luther has some problems with this. So he writes up 95 arguments. These are theological issues about the abuses of selling indulgences. He said the Pope doesn't get to allow people out of purgatory. You don't pay for indulgences. You repent of your sin. You don't just give money. Anyway, 95 theses in Latin calling for a scholastic debate. He nailed them to all the churches. There are four churches in Wittenberg. He wrote the Disputation of Dr. Martin Luther on the Power and Efficacy of Indulgences against John Tetzel. Well, this gets the attention of the Pope. Pope Leo X wrote a papal bull. Bulla is the word for the seal, the wax seal. And it's called Exsurge Domine. The name of the bull comes from the first line. Arise, Lord, and defend thine own vineyard against the wild beast that is devouring it. And it goes on, talking about Martin Luther, threatening to excommunicate him. They've burned his books. He has 60 days to recant. So before that time is up, he goes outside the city, to the edge of the city, underneath this oak. There's still an oak tree there now. And they start a bonfire, and they throw books on church law into it. And he takes the bull, and he holds it over the fire, and he says, because you godless book have grieved or shamed the holiness of the Father, be saddened and consumed by the eternal flames of hell. Pretty much breaking with the Catholic Church. He goes back to his room and writes against the bull of the Antichrist. This is what Wycliffe said. This is what Huss said. This is what Luther's successor Melanchthon says. This is what Ulrich Zwingli and his successor Bullinger says about the Pope. It's what Calvin says and John Knox says. It's what John Wesley, who founded the Methodist Church, says. It's what Roger Williams, who started the Baptist Church in America in Providence, Rhode Island, says. And it's what the Seventh-day Adventists still say. In conclusion, if you remember nothing from my lessons, here's the one-word summary. The Catholic Church at this time says you are saved by the merit that you merit by observing the sacraments and doing works of mercy that are distributed from that treasury of mercy in the sky only through the church. Martin Luther, it's all about justification. We are justified by grace through faith. All right, any questions?